Get exclusive content you just can't wait to hear. Hit us with your feedback. We want to know how you feel. So download the Shiny Radio. Get it free from the App Store. Download the Shiny Radio. See our features and much more. Download the Shiny Radio app for free now.
Welcome, welcome to Verke Radio, iHeartRadio. This is Get Your Business Right Show with Michael Muse. I'm the fearless coach, aka Mr. Broadcastpreneur. Overcoming your fears is not an option. I am blessed beyond measure to have the one and only HG Harris. We are here to do part two, solving the race problem in America. See, we always hear people talk about the problem. We hear people talk about this and that, but he is someone who has taken his experience, taken his expertise, taken his passion, taken his heart, and he has put it on paper, and he wants to be part of the solution, not just for now, but for many generations later. So I want to bring the some and definitely introduce the many. AJ Harris, how you doing, AJ Harris? We back for part two. I'm excited. Yes, yes.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Beautiful. Well, I'm excited about it, man. I admire what you're doing. And your focus on these things for Black History Month, extremely important because people need to know.
Well, it's an absolute fact that the politicians need to read your book. The school age should need to read your book. All the universities need to be reading your book. Anyone who has an influence on America need to be reading your book because it's the blueprint to putting us in a situation where it's an even playing field. So we could truly get to that place that Martin Luther King said himself, where I could live in a country where my children will be judged by the content of the character and not by the color of their skin. And Dr. Harris, when we talked in part one, we ended it just on a spiritual end and just a spiritual feeling that was taking place. And fortunate enough, you were blessed enough to see and witness these things happen on TV and et cetera. My question for you, I want to take the audience back. What were you doing during the 1963 March on Washington? And how did that speech affect you personally?
Well, you know something, Michael, one of the interesting things is that I went there as a college student. And I was in New York in Columbia University. And when we heard about the March on Washington, I was actually afraid to go because there had been so much controversy about it. There was going to be a riot and 250,000 people there, and there were going to be angry Black people and angry white people. And I really waited until the last minute. And so I missed the buses going down. I literally hitched a ride with a fella to go down there. Me and a friend of mine, we literally hitchhiked a ride. A guy who was going, an African guy, was going down to see it. We thought about it. We said, now, if he's going to see it, we got to go.
Exactly. You figure you can't let someone who wasn't born in this country have more grit, more tenacity, and more vigor for the struggle than you, because you're living in it. So I totally understand that.
And you know what it been, but living in it, you still had that fear, because that fear was what was taught. When we got there, he gave us a ride. We got there, he dropped us off, me and Ashley. And the thing that impressed me most was how orderly it was. And there were buses from all around the country to get 250,000 people there. And believe me, a large percentage, a major percentage, were Black folks. I mean, we're talking about, if there were 250,000 people there, there were 200,000 Black folks there. And I remember getting off, and when we got out of the car, we walked around, and I looked up, and I saw a bus, and all the buses had the name of the town that they came from so people could figure out how to get back. And I saw a bus that said Wilmington, North Carolina. I was like, hallelujah, hallelujah.
You figured that was your gateway to getting back home.
That's it, man. So I went there, and just to, when you are in the spiritual vibration of where you're supposed to be, things work. I go there, and I was hungry because when we got down there, we didn't really have any money that much, and we didn't eat. When I went over to the bus from Wilmington, the first person getting off the bus was Arnold Robinson, who was born the same day I was in the same hospital in Wilmington, North Carolina. Mm. He had on a suit and a tie like he was going to church, and he had a black briefcase. And I said, man, you look great. I said, you know, y'all got anything to eat? I'm hungry. The brother popped open the briefcase, and the briefcase was full of chicken sandwiches.
Praise God. Look at that. See, look full at of that. Chicken sandwiches.
Full of chicken sandwiches. And so we ate, and then we marched. And the march was so orderly. And the interesting thing was, other than when they were singing, it was quiet. It was absolutely quiet. Wasn't nobody talking. You didn't hear anybody yelling and screaming. It was very quiet. Then you had the songs going, "We Shall Overcome," and we're marching along. And that created a sense of peace. You know, whatever fear I had that it was going to be a riot and that people were going to get beaten up with billy clubs, because this is the context we're coming out of. And many of the Pettus Bridge, the march to many of the marches in the South ended up in violence. And we're thinking, man, you come in the march on Washington, they're going to have something for us.
Mm.
So that's how that fear can work in your minds.
Yes.
But we marched, and when we got there, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, when you could just see a sea of people. And when they started to speak, there were a number of speakers, Dr. King, there were a lot of speakers before him. But when Dr. King spoke, they had a sound system and all that. But it was as though everybody stopped breathing so that you wouldn't even hear the breath. It was so quiet that you almost felt like he was standing right next to you talking to you.
Mm.
You know how you often have the echo? And I don't know, maybe it was because we were outside and there were no real walls for the sound to bounce off. You didn't really hear that echo. You just heard that sound, his sound coming through. And he spoke in a very conversational manner. He wasn't speaking in, like some of the old Southern Baptist preaching manner. He interjected that too, but he was speaking in a conversational manner. So it was like he was talking to you. And yes. Man, let me tell you, everybody paid attention. Everybody. It was amazing that people just stopped what they were doing. It's almost when he was speaking, it was as though time stood still and heard every word. And I can't even tell you how long the speech was. It seemed like it was all day long. But then when it was over, it seemed like it was over too fast.
Mm.
So that day, when he finished speaking, at that point, it wasn't nothing else to be said. At that point, it's like, this thing is cooked. Let's head home and let's get back to work. Let's start working for justice. The interesting thing that happened, though, because we'd come down, like literally the night before, and we'd been walking all day, I was very, very tired. And meanwhile, me and my friend got separated. He went his way and I went mine. And I was so tired, I laid down on a bench they had there in the park.
Mm.
I dozed off. Because you know me, Michael, I can sleep anywhere, anytime, under any circumstance.
So World War III can be jumping off.
That's it. And I get sleepy, I'm gone. But the thing that really, and I didn't understand it at the time, but I understood it later. When I awoke, I felt like I didn't know where I was. All the paper had been picked up, and really, people didn't drop a lot of paper. You know, you would think you have a quarter of a million people there, that's going to be paper all over. No, there was no paper on the ground. All the people were gone, and it was though it had never happened.
Mm.
And I didn't understand it at the time. I was like, man, this is weird. But then 50 years later, we're still standing there at that same monument. And the things that Dr. King said needed to happen still have not happened. We're not sitting at the table of brotherhood. We're not judging people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. And so that was the meaning, I think. The spiritual meaning was it had happened, but the cancer was not excised. The illness of racism was not removed. It was a shining light, but it was still on a dark night.
Yes, man, that's absolutely powerful right there, AJ. I think you really ushered the audience in to that symbolic day. Because most of America have heard the speech. But to hear for someone who was there and to feel the energy, to feel the vibe, and to be polarized to take on justice in a whole new light. So for you, was at that point there, you saw that social justice had to be a part of your life at that point?
Had to be a part of my life and had to be a part of everybody's life. I think that what we felt there was a vibration that you can't stand by silently anymore. A vibration that you cannot be afraid anymore. Just being there, you had to overcome fear as a Black person. You know, there were a lot of freedom riders and a lot of walks and a lot of protests, but everybody didn't show up. You know, everybody sort of did what they could do based on where they were at. You know, there was some old lady, she said, I ain't going down to march, but I'll fix some sandwiches because they're going to get hungry. Okay. So everybody did their part in accordance with their portion. But everybody left. I know for me, I left with the sense that we could not be stopped. That was the feeling. That was the feeling I got there was if a Black man could get, and you know, when they say 250,000 people, I don't think that count is accurate. I really think it was many more. You know, I attended the Million Man March. I attended the Million Family March. I attended President Barack Obama's inauguration. And from what I saw at that time, there were many more than 250,000 people.
You're right, AJ. Some records say that the true estimate, it was close to 1 million.
Yes. Because when you look at the distance between those two monuments, it was full, wasn't halfway. You know, I was looking at the Trump inauguration, and you could see all these spots of empty space. You know, you had a crowd up here at this point, but at that day, there was no empty space between monument to monument.
Yeah, and what I was told, and you were there for the 63 march, you were shoulder to shoulder.
Absolutely.
You had to, it was excuse me. You had to hustle and bustle to get through it. And it was excuse me every step of the way. There was no clear path for getting through.
Never. It was totally shoulder to shoulder, heart to heart, but with absolute respect. Nobody bumped, nobody stumped, nobody riled up. When you move through, people just almost like let you through. If you're going somewhere, let you through. So I think the estimates say close to 1 million. I'd absolutely agree. And it's interesting how the systemic nature of, we might say, trying to define what Blackness is. I don't think that the press, the mainstream world, would like to acknowledge that Dr. King had 1 million people there. So everybody gets stuck on that number, 250,000. But for those who were there, if you could compare, and that's the beauty about being a part of history, because then you can see for yourself. I saw the Million Man March. I saw Dr. King, and believe me, the crowds, Dr. King's crowd, if any, was even bigger.
So you're saying that 63 crowds were King much more louder and more people than the Million Man March?
I'd say more people.
More people.
Not louder. It was very quiet. Like I said, you other than singing, it was very introspective. You know, I think that many people were there, were very keenly aware that they were a part of history. You know, you can go to a parade and it was a good parade and everybody had a good time. But when you were there, you had that sense that you were a part of history. So as you say, you know how your mama used to say, be on your good behavior.
That's right.
Everybody was on their good behavior. I didn't see not a single instance of disagreement, dishonor, disruption. Everybody was on their good behavior.
Wow. And you really struck, you really hit some good points there. Now, me personally, one march I did make, the Million Family March. Mm-hmm. And you said you attended that march also.
Yes.
And so for me, that was symbolic. I was able to take my older son with me, and he was, I think he was around 10, 11 at the time, and 9 or 10 at the time. And for him, it was the first time for him that he saw that it was important to be Black. It was important for Black people to be family. It was important for us to work together, but not just in talk, but do it in action. And that if you want to build a great community, it all starts with the family, that you have to have a family in order to build a great community. And so for me, that was a great experience. But for you, you have made every single important event that affected Black people in this country, from King's March all the way to now, up until, like, say, even Barack's inauguration. You say you were there also.
I was there. And you know something? I want to share something. The Million Man March. And I was intentional about going there because I had been to the 63 March. The Million Man March had a different spin. Okay, it was stimulated by Minister Farrakhan. There was a very Muslim overview to it. And at the time, I was living in Cleveland. And we had buses. And I'll never forget that night. We had at least a dozen buses lined up.
Mm.
And the Black motorcyclists, the brothers on motorcycle, gave the bus an escort. Give the dozen buses or so an escort. So you know how the police, when you have a big funeral and they go, they on the motorcycle, they're making noise, they go, and they go up and block that intersection, then block the intersection, then block the next intersection.
Yeah.
That's what the brothers did.
Mm.
As we were rolling out of Cleveland.
Wow.
Right on up to the expressway. When we got on, was it Highway 80?
Yeah.
Coming across. When we hit 80, and they escorted the bus, man. They were in front and they were in the back.
Like I said, it was hitting those intersections. So,
yes,
the crowd, when you lowered the bus, it was just straight, no stoplights.
No stoplights, straight running.
To the freeway.
Straight running.
And once you hit the I-80, you hit the turnpike.
That's it. And when we got to that place, there's that place in Western Pennsylvania where everybody stops. I think that's the part where that one of the other highways, you know, the North-South Highway crisscrosses there. I won't say Bryn Mawr, but it was somewhere in Pennsylvania. But when we hit there and those motorcycles drove in, we saw a lot of the policemen over there.
Oh, Breezewood. Was it Breezewood?
Yes. Breezewood. That's it. Man, when we rolled into Breezewood, the cops were just standing there. They didn't know what to do. They just like, let me just stay over here. Because they got a whole ton of buses. And I can't say how many motorcycles. I would say we had at least 50. At least 50. And you know that sound the motorcycles make, man. You felt like you were important.
That's right.
Now, back in 63, I remember a friend telling me that the Black folks had trouble getting buses. The white people wouldn't rent them buses. You think these are the days of segregation still. 1963, we were still coming out of it, but we weren't out of it. And so many of the buses bringing people to the March on Washington with 63 were the Black bus companies, the church buses, the neighborhood buses, you know. And that was a big difference because this was an event that Black people planned it, Dr. King. They executed it, and they kept it safe and meaningful. So that was a moment in history. You know, it was said that President Kennedy and the powers that be wanted Dr. King not to do it. You know, they were trying to say, well, you know, it can be dangerous. And, you know, we bring that many people. They were thinking along the lines of what had happened in the South, like at the Pettus Bridge. When you bring a significant group of people, that they're going to be this police presence is going to be trouble. And when they realized that Dr. King said, hey, I don't care. We're coming to Washington. We have a message to bring to Washington. Then the leadership, the one thing when you're resolute about what you want to do, whoever the opposition is, if they want to stay in the game, they're going to figure out a way to come in there with you. They'll go through the motions, that's for sure. They didn't want it to happen, but when they saw they couldn't make it, couldn't stop it, they got on board.
Well, AJ, we come to this point in time, take a quick break, and we're going to come right back. Well, we're back. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here on the Get Your Business Right show, and we have the phenomenal best-selling author, AJ Harris, with his book, Solving the Race Issue in America. And he has truly taken us back in time on just the experience and the everything that was going through with the march in Washington, even the marches up to today. So HJ, question now is, at what point in time did you decide to take all that experience? Because if the audience didn't know, you're a retired attorney, fame attorney at that. You've worked with the best of the best. If I'm correct, anyone who's seen the movie American Gangster, and one about Frank Lucas, if I'm correct, you were on that legal. You was on that legal team.
Well, I tell you, I represented the lawyer who represented Frank Lucas.
Yeah.
That guy was so bad, his lawyers needed lawyers.
That's right. His lawyer needed a lawyer.
So you were up in that mix. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you were the lawyer's lawyer.
Yes, sir, man. That's a whole story for another day. But
yes, it is. But I just want to show the audience that you're not someone who is speaking from your imagination. You're not speaking just from your scholastic skills and achievement, but you're speaking from your actual life experience and being around the people and seeing the people who are on the front lines of making things change and making things happen. And so what point did you get to say, hey, you know what? We do have a serious problem in America, and let me put this to paper to have a blueprint to be a catalyst of change in this country.
You know, when I'd started writing this book before 2008, because I was seeing, you know, we were involved in politics in North Carolina, and I was seeing that there was still so much division along racial lines. We were going, at that time, we were dealing with the school system. Charter schools were beginning to spring up. And we saw that the public schools were beginning to be decentralized and really segregated from within to without. They began to set up, they call them charter schools. That was just beginning to take hold. And so that was one of the things that really stimulated me to do the initial version of the book. But then by 2008, when President Obama was elected, to show the impact and the power of racism, I'm an educated Black man. I graduated from an Ivy League school. I've had a good life. But yet the paradigm of racism, the paradigm of slavery was so strong, I did not believe that there would ever be a Black president. I did not believe it. And then when the president, the candidate was Barack Hussein Obama.
Especially the middle name, Hussein.
Hussein Obama. Okay. I just could not believe that. And so I say to our listeners, racism is so powerful that there are many instances in which you're locked in a mindset and don't even know it. And so when President Obama was elected, I had a spiritual transformation. I stopped writing the book. It was really, that version was pretty much finished. As a writer, one of my mantras is to always finish the book. It's easier to improve upon a finished work. You can't improve upon an unfinished work because you don't know what it is. So whenever I approach a book, I always finish it. Yes. I write it. If there are holes, if there are pieces, I always bring it to an end. I'll get to that point to write the end. And so that evolution, I'd gotten to the point of writing the end, but I did not see that the book had value because with President Barack Obama being elected, I felt that if every Black person in America voted for him, that's still not enough votes to get him elected.
That's right.
And at that time, he got the greatest number of votes, I think, of any president up to that time. And so I said to myself, millions of white people voted for a Black man named Barack Hussein Obama. We have solved the issue of racism in America. That we have made a breakthrough as a nation. That we have made a breakthrough as a spiritual entity on the planet. But a couple of days after he was elected, you heard these rumblings of, take our country back. Take our country back. And it got to the point where I was speaking at a place once, and the speaker ahead of me got quite a rousing applause when he mentioned something about taking our country back. And so when I came on, I said, I was being sarcastic, but I said, I want to thank the so-and-so here, this gentleman, because I did not know that our country had been taken by anybody. and I definitely want to get with him to find out who took it. And when did this happen? But once that began to develop, take our country back. And then the next set of elections, when you had the Tea Party.
Yes.
And think of the symbolism of the Tea Party. The whole idea with the Tea Party in the Revolutionary War was to take America away from oppression, from an evil ruler, from King George. And when by the midterm elections, you had that turnaround, and I really thought that this racism thing was coming back. It was not over. It was coming back. But then when President Barack Obama got elected a second time, I was confused. I remember one of the top Republican strategists was on, I think, Fox News, and he couldn't even contain his shock. He kept saying, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And I found myself saying the same thing. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Because I've been hearing so much of that take our country back, but still he was able to win again. But once the end of his second term, and we saw him doing his second term, this take our country back, the Republican agenda, the conservative agenda grew stronger and stronger. And the moment he couldn't run again, and when Donald Trump came, the mantra now was make America great again. Like America hadn't been great all along. Mm-hmm.
Like I say, when was America great? Was the idea you think in your mind? When was it great? Or yeah. Better yet, who was it great for?
Yeah.
Was it great for America as a whole, or was it only great for a certain group?
Absolutely. And the implication then was during the years of Obama, America wasn't great.
Yeah, you're right.
See, that the only thing different, that it happened over the last 200 and some years was that you had a Black man who was president for 8 years, and that became the mantra, make America great again. And they started wearing the red hats. Okay. And so that meant, let me know that the cancer of racism was not only alive and well, it had metastasized through every level of our country.
Mm.
And that took us to that point where on January 6th, you literally had an insurrection. I have friends that still the debate. They cannot believe it. But I told them beforehand, when you see that movement, when you hear how you can take a country and have a white police officer kneel on a Black man's neck for over 8 minutes in literally on public television for all the world to see. And then the entire country, the entire leadership flips the switch. And instead of talking about the injustice of that death, they're talking about people burning down buildings. They switch the focus from a real moral injustice to property damage.
Yes.
And so it really said, this type of mindset told me that I needed to write a book that could help all people, the good people who understood the golden rule, who as Christians or Muslims or whatever religious persuasion you are, who one common thought among all the religions is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
That's right.
And if you follow that, you'd never have slavery. You'd never have the mean things that have happened to Black people and to white people. Mean things have happened to them too. So that led me to say, it's got to be a spiritual awakening.
Yes.
Because if that simple principle is being violated, not just violated individually, but systemically and institutionally, then we have to attack the solution in the same way, spiritually. And so that led me to the point of laying out the book. And the reason the book is written in the fashion it is, it requires three things. In order to bring America together in a spiritual breakthrough, it requires, number one, that all parties, white people and Black people, acknowledge what has been done, to understand the history. You cannot go forward without recognizing the terrible deeds that were done in the history.
That's right.
And these are deeds that indicate that you cannot commit some of these deeds and still say, I believe in God. And so that was the first step. And so when we wrote the book, we wanted to cover, include enough history that the reader could understand the dimensions of the project, of the problem.
Yes.
In our big read, for this Black History Month, we've been reading. We've had college students and veterans from the community, people reading the Solving the Race Issue in America live in a webinar and on Facebook Live. And we've had students from Brandeis University, Columbia University, Morehouse, Tuskegee, Florida A&M, North Carolina Central, numerous other schools. And what we've been seeing is as these young people read this work, they say, I didn't know that. I had no idea. The interesting thing, though, is we have predominantly Black people, Black students, and because I wanted to tell the Black story. 75% of our audience is white. Because there are a lot of white people that they know something is wrong.
And they don't have that knowledge.
They're seeking that knowledge. And at the end of each webinar, we have an interaction. All the people on can speak. And the word that keeps coming through is, I just didn't know that. And, many times people have that need to validate. In the era of fake news, many times folks have no idea what's true and what's not true. And so we'll say things and they'll read things in the book and they'll go want to validate. And they go like, wow. There really was an insurrection of 1898. It was filed under race war, but it was really an insurrection. It's the only coup that's ever taken place on American soil. Or there really was a white Declaration of Independence where prominent white men in the South, in North Carolina, actually wrote a document saying we'll never be ruled by men of African origin. It is our duty to put them in their place. We respect them, but we respect them in their place. And so when they read it, they go like, my God, they're stunned. The young Black people reading, they're going, my God, they're stunned. And so that's step one, acknowledgement. Step two is the breakthrough step. The Bible says, if you've committed a wrong against the people, you have to first acknowledge that wrong. And then second, you have to ask forgiveness.
That's right.
And that's where the hang up is right now. because many white people say, I didn't own slaves. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't kill anybody. I didn't bullwhip anybody, and none of my family did. Why should I apologize? And I thought about that for a while. That really bothered me because I said, well, I'm not asking you to do anything other than say, hey, what they did was wrong. And I wasn't present, but I apologize on their behalf because clearly if I'm white in America, I am heir to this whole agenda. America's the only country built on 300 years of free labor.
Mm.
You know, there were somewhere over 4 million slaves in America. 4 million. Okay. So when you look at that, you say, so if I can ask forgiveness, it shows a manifestation of do unto others if you would have them do unto you. In other words, I didn't do it, my people didn't do it, but I apologize on their behalf because I would never like anybody to be treated like your people were treated 100 years ago.
And you know what you said there, AJ, it reminded me of Jane Elliott. I know you're familiar with Jane Elliott. Mm-hmm. And she was in a conference college room, and she asked the students and the audience, if you know, she asked them, would they trade places with black people? Raise your hand. And nobody raised their hand. Mm-hmm. And she said, if you know it's taking place, how can you just sit by and say nothing about it?
Exactly. And that's the point. You know, when you look at the theory of the bully, whenever you see a person being bullied, there are three things happening. There's the victim, the person who is being bullied, suffering. There's the bully, the person who's perpetrating the suffering. And then there's the bystander who stands by and does nothing.
Mm.
And so when you stand by and do nothing, you become a co-conspirator.
Mm. Say that again, Dr. Hicks, for the audience. If you do nothing, what, Dr. Hicks?
If you stand by and do nothing, you become a co-conspirator. You become an ally of the bully. If you see a man beating a woman and you stand there and do nothing, you become his ally because you had the power to do something and you refused to do it. And so you can't stand by. There's a great saying of why you should get involved. It was written by a German. He was talking about the agent Hitler when in the Third Reich. And he said, when they came for the trade unionists, I did not speak up because I'm not a trade unionist. When they came for the Catholics, I did not speak up. I'm not a Catholic. When they came for the Jews, I did not speak up. I am not a Jew. When they came for me, there was nobody left to speak up.
AJ, you have shared a wealth of knowledge. What we're going getting close to the end now. What is the one point you want to leave about your book to really touch the mind, heart, and the souls of the people? Read it.
A couple of points. Number one, get the book, Solving the Race Issue in America. It's on Amazon by H.J. Harris. That's number one. Number two, all of the readings that we've done, these live webinars we've done during Black History Month, is available online. You can go and watch them at thebigread.info, www.thebigread.info. And then three, to recognize the spiritual aspect of what is happening. That once you've acknowledged it, once you've asked forgiveness, then atonement is important. Because the spiritual process says atonement must be made after a great wrong has been committed.
Mm.
But atonement requires a mindset of justice. You cannot receive atonement from a person who does not share your pain.
Mm.
They often say, the Indian said, you can't understand who I am until you walk a mile in my moccasins.
That's right.
And so for our listeners to study, learn more, read our book, read other books about the history of America with respect to racism. Number two, to become a committee of one. You know, a committee of one says, hey, I am not going to go along with it. If I see a wrong, I'm going to say something. I may not go out and jump on somebody to make them stop doing the wrong, but I'm going to say, you're not right. You're wrong. You should do this. And then number three, to share the information. The idea, the power of thought is that it's like, you know, the beautiful thing about a rose. If you bring a rose into a room, in short order, everybody in the room can smell that rose. Well, the power of thought is this, that when you start advocating positive thoughts, when you say people should receive justice, when you say people should be able to live where they want, when you say people should get just treatment, when you say all of those things that should be said so that we can truly live that life, liberty, and justice that America is supposed to be about, when you can say it, when you can
that's right, yes,
you'll bring it about.
That's right, yes.
So that's my request to the audience, to learn, okay, to understand, and then to share what they have learned and be a committee of one for change.
And so where can they order?
They can order the book. It's available on Amazon. They're promoting it through Amazon. It's available on Walmart. Now has it on their website, Barnes & Noble. On virtually every digital website, it's available now. So Amazon. And you can learn more about us. Our website is www.solvingtheraceissue.com. www.solvingtheraceissue.com. And also on Facebook, we have the Solving the Race Issue in America movement. You can go on Facebook, Solving the Race Issue in America movement. Join that Facebook page because we give a consistent set of ideas and conferences and webinars to help people get through this racist paradigm that we've been trapped in.
Yes. AJ, you have taken us through the perils of this country's dark side, but you've also shown us the light and shown us the implications of coming together and having a blueprint that can shine beyond the generations that we're in right now. I'm just thoroughly blessed and honored to have you on the show, because without people like you, our world will stay stagnant. But because of you and because of your experience and your commitment and your dedication and putting the time in to see that the issues that we deal with, there is a solution and that you have a solution. And we just need to put the solution in place. So I thank you so much for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, we have AJ Harris here to share with you how to get in contact with him and get his book. Because, ladies and gentlemen, without me, without you, there is no me. And so guess what? I love you. God loves you. And there's nothing you can do about it. This is the Get Your Business Right Show on VerK Radio, The Power Woman. See you next time.
Get exclusive content you just can't wait to hear. Hit us with your feedback. We want to know how you feel. So download the Shiny Radio. Get it free from the App Store. Download the Shiny Radio. See our features and much more. Download the Shiny Radio app for free now.